Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Mark Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Back in 2001, the fall of 2001, someone sent out a series of letters containing anthrax to a number of the country's major news organizations, ABC, CBS, and NBC, and also to two Democratic senators. For a long time, the identity of this individual or individuals responsible was probably one of the great unsolved crimes here in the United States. However, early last month, the FBI announced that it had found the person responsible. They said that it was an Army scientist named Bruce Ivins, that he was responsible and he was the only person responsible for the 2001 anthrax attacks. Many of his friends and coworkers said that they believed that he was not guilty. However, the government continues to stand by its conclusions that Ivins was the person who sent out the letters containing anthrax that sickened a number of people and were responsible for the death of five. Bruce Ivins himself is no longer around to face charges because shortly before the announcement by the FBI that he was to be indicted, Bruce Ivins committed suicide. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with an investigative reporter from the Washington Post who has followed this story. In fact, she wrote a book about it. It was published not too long ago. The title of her book is The Killer Strain, Anthrax and a Government Exposed. Our guest is Marilyn Thompson. She is an assistant managing editor for investigations at the Post, where her investigative team has won two Pulitzer Prizes for public service. If you're interested in taking a look at the book, it's published by HarperCollins, and I'm sure that you can still find it. It was published in 2003, originally in hardcover. She's continued to follow that story and has contributed recently some stories to the Post on this. And we called her and asked her if she would spend some more time talking with us, and she was good enough to say, yeah, she would. So we appreciate her joining us, and we're talking here this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome, certainly from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, whichever the numbers works for you, whether you're here in Champaign-Urbana, so you want to do 333-9455, or you're around Illinois and Indiana, maybe you're even listening on the internet across the country, you can use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Whichever number works best for you, you're certainly welcome to call. The only thing we ask is that people just try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone who is listening is certainly welcome to call. Ms. Thompson, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And you?
Oh, just fine.
Good. Well, I appreciate very much your spending some more time talking with us. You know, when this story broke, I thought, well, it'd be interesting to try to do an update on this. And right away, I thought about you since you had spent a lot of time following it. So I really appreciate you talking with us.
Yeah, glad to do it.
Well, at the last time that we talked, now we talked when the killer strain came out, and
yes.
At that point, the only individual that had ever been publicly mentioned as a person of interest, and that's sort of the term that's used,
right.
Was this man, Mr. Hatfill.
Correct.
Stephen Hatfill, and we certainly talked about that, and he appears in the book. We talked about that. And, well, I want to sort of get back to him, Mr. Hatfill, but at what point did you become aware of Bruce Ivins and of the fact that then he seemed to become the target of the investigation?
Well, you should know that I put this story aside for a few years. So I was not following it as closely as, in fact, many reporters had put it aside.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only until actually the LA Times broke the initial story about Bruce Ivins, a great reporter there named David Willman, who worked for me briefly for a while, and I kind of got him interested in the case. He found that Bruce Ivins had become the principal suspect, but unfortunately only after Dr. Ivins had killed himself.
So it sounds as if even people who had spent time following this story, would it be correct to say that even people who had followed it were surprised by the revelation that, in fact, the FBI was identifying Bruce Ivins as the person responsible?
Yes, I think the press had turned its attention away from the case for some months. As you know, there had been an FBI lawsuit filed by Stephen Hatfield that had involved many members of the press who had been interested in the story, and they kind of turned away from this in the course of that litigation. And I applaud David Wellman for, you know, taking a hard look at what was going on. Many of the scientists at Fort Detrick, which is where Dr. Ivins worked, apparently were aware that they had narrowed their focus and that there was intense pressure on Dr. Ivins. But that's a very secretive world, and that had not really leaked out.
Mm. Back when you really were spending a lot of time with this story, had you ever come across Bruce Ivins?
No, never. Huh. Very mild-mannered scientist, kept to himself in the lab. He was a well-loved figure in that laboratory. At his memorial service, people, including the top officials of the Army's community out there, stepped forward to say what a wonderful man he was. But I was not aware of him. It turned out that he had actually been one of the scientists so expert in the field of anthrax that the FBI had been using him as an expert source in the early phases of its investigation. So he had been part of a very tight circle of people who were aware of what the FBI thought and what the FBI was doing as it began to try to solve the case.
Yeah. I think one of the things that people were really curious about, or at least one of the questions they were asking, was given that for such a long time, only one individual, Stephen Hatfield, had been publicly identified as being somebody that they were interested in, and also given the other bit that you just mentioned, the fact that Bruce Ivins had even been working to assist in his, you know, his professional capacity as an expert on anthrax,
yeah,
had actually been working to assist the FBI. At what happened to cause this major shift from having Stephen Hatfield be the person of interest to Bruce Ivins being the person of interest?
Well, the FBI had been alluding for some time in various court hearings on the Hatfield lawsuit to scientific analysis that was underway. In fact, they convinced a judge at one point to delay Dr. Hatfield's lawsuit while they attempted to conclude this scientific analysis. They had shipped samples of the anthrax that surfaced in the letters sent to the Senate out to a number of labs all over the U.S. and the world to try to identify the genetic composition of the material, to do DNA analysis of it, and then to match it to what they found in various scientists' laboratories. And this process, which was very difficult, and the FBI has said really cutting-edge science, apparently led them to a flask that was in Dr. Ivins' possession. And so behind the scenes, while all of us were not looking, the FBI was working deeply with the scientific community around the globe to try to pinpoint where this anthrax may have come from.
Mm-hmm. Just to stay with Dr. Hatfield for just a second, Stephen Hatfield, this is the individual that had previously been identified as the person of interest by the government. He was never charged. He continued to assert that he was not guilty, and he didn't have anything to do with it. And as you say, then he sued the government, and they settled for almost $6 million. I wonder now if you go back and you talk to people who have been involved in this investigation and you ask them about Hatfield, what do they say? Do they say, well, look, he truly was the best suspect that we had, or by virtue of hindsight, do they say, well, you know, for some reason we fixated on him and we just did a bad job? I mean, how do people, you know, even people who are willing to talk off the record about this, how do they talk about the whole business with Stephen Hadfield?
Well, the FBI is not about to acknowledge that it did a bad job with this. It says that it followed the normal investigative process that it would use with any case of this sort. And in the beginning, if you recall, they did enlist support from the public to step forward and identify any person that they thought might have had something to do with this, which was one of the things that led them initially to Dr. Hadfield. They had a couple of tips from people who believed that he might be a potential suspect. And so they proceeded with that and began interviewing a very wide range of people who knew Dr. Hadfield, who had worked with him over the course of many years. He had a very exotic background, including time overseas in Rhodesia. And so they went all over the world talking to people about Stephen Hadfield, while, of course, gathering circumstantial evidence that they felt linked him to this, including bloodhounds who identified by scent his connection with the anthrax packets that they let the dog sniff. That was one of the early leads. There was handwriting analysis that they felt drew a strong correlation to Dr. Hadfield. And some of the standard techniques that the FBI uses in these types of investigations led them to believe that this was somebody they definitely needed to know a lot more about. They conducted searches of his home. They found materials that they believed to be intriguing and, you know, did a very full sweep of this man and his family and friends. And so, you know, did they do a bad job? In hindsight, it certainly appears that way. It's still confounding to many of us who followed this case that you had not just anybody, the Attorney General of the United States stepping forward to call Stephen Hadfield a person of interest. And this, of course, led to a very major lawsuit and eventual settlement.
Is this case now considered to be closed?
Good question. The FBI made very clear that they believe they had their man and that they were ready to, quote, close the case. They have not done so officially, although they say they are on the course of doing that right now. Director Mueller has been called to talk to a Senate committee on September 17th, partly about the anthrax matter. It wouldn't surprise any of us if they announced it officially closed. But there are some big remaining holes in the case against Dr. Ivins that they are going to have to, at some point, address. Thus far, they have not.
Mm-hmm. That certainly was another set of questions that I'd like to talk about. But just before we go to another caller, I know that there are people in Washington who are concerned about how the investigation was carried out and about the conclusions. Is there some talk of there being any kind of more than just the directors appearing either in open or closed session, any kind of extended sort of congressional hearings or inquiry into the way this investigation was carried out?
Yes, there has been talk of that. There's been nothing of that sort scheduled yet. Just yesterday, the New York Times filed a motion in U.S. District Court here seeking the unsealing of documents in this case dating back to its beginning. It's very obvious that the press, if no one else, wants to take a very hard look at how this case was conducted.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Marilyn Thompson. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and editor for The Washington Post. She is the author of a book on the anthrax attacks that came out a couple of years ago. The title of her book is The Killer Strain, Anthrax and a Government Exposed. HarperCollins is the publisher. We're talking about the recent developments in this case, including the naming by the FBI of an individual, a scientist who worked in biodefense for the Army named Bruce Ivins. They said that he was the person who was responsible and the only person responsible for the anthrax attacks of 2001. Questions are welcome. We have someone standing by here in Urbana. We will talk with them on line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? I found this really interesting. And I've read your work, ma'am, online, but I'm going to go to when he was found dead and announced to be the perpetrator of this act. A friend of his in Wyoming wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times who basically said, you know, he was a decent man, conscientious, caring, whatever, a little quirky, little, you know, on the weird side, but very bright, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then later, about a week later, the New York Times ran an article more in detail about what happened, you know, sequentially, how they had, when they found the strain, and the strain was called the Ames strain.
Yes.
Which was, and I think you really need to concentrate on this, because it was discovered in 19, according to the article, it was discovered in 1981 in a dead animal cow in Texas, and immediately taken and found to be very virulent, so it was sent to the USAMRID and weaponized in, like, early 80s, like 82, 83. Well, I wrote a letter to the New York Times detailing my feelings about this, which was never published. As a matter of fact, I even got a kickback on it. Usually you get a, you know, thanks for your letter, blow
right.
off. And it detailed the fact that I went back and I excerpted from the bioweapons treaty, which was signed in 72 and fully enacted in 1975. It's about 800-word document. And if you read it, you know, it's in chapter sections and stuff, and it says in the first two or three, it says, you know, we all agree in partners. But in there it says that there won't even be research into this stuff. So I'm wondering, in my letter, I basically postulated the idea that Dr. Ivins was basically, maybe, let's say he did it, but no one ever talks about why he did it. Maybe he did it because he realized, we're making this stuff that can murder people. We're not even supposed to be doing it. I mean, maybe he got a conscience about it. Maybe he became upset and did this act to say, look, America, look what your government is doing against treaty. And I, like I said, I've never received a return on this, but I'm just curious what you think of that, because when I found out that it was this what they call the Ames strain, you feel like these guys are out walking around, you know, finding dead cattle and animals and saying, oh, hey, this is a virulent form of X. Let's make a weapon out of it. And I'm wondering if you have any feelings about that, or if there's no one's even discussed the legality of this.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, and there's lots of speculation about what really goes on in the labs of Fort Detrick. I can tell you the little that I officially know. Mm-hmm. Under the bioweapons agreements that were negotiated during the Nixon years, supposedly the production of bioweapons stopped. And after that, the U.S. Army continued to have facilities like USAMRID at Fort Detrick to work on defensive measures, such as the production of vaccines that would protect U.S. troops from these terrible things that they could encounter on the battleground. That was the work that Dr. Ivins and his lab crew were doing. They were working on vaccine testing. In order to do that, they had to, of course, expose animals to the real stuff, the virulent strain. And so that's why they had that in their possession. That's the official story.
Well,
you will hear all kinds of theories and speculation about.
I don't want to sound conspiratorialist, but it just seems so convenient that the guy takes 25 acetaminophen tablets and just drops out of the scene. But I'm still curious as to why. I mean, everybody, the whole issue has been glossed over. Like, I mean, in 81 they find this. In the early 80s they weaponized it. That, you know, how the process was not detailed, but you can find it online. But the thing is it's interesting that they're, well, let's see if we can do this and, you know, retain its potency. It's just, I mean, I'm not like some, you know, left-leaning. I just think it's kind of interesting that whole issue has been glossed over by the media. No one's ever said, well, this is weird. I mean, this guy's been written off as a crackpot, which he ostensibly was, but I'm just saying maybe his motivation, maybe he's delusional, but it just strikes me as really odd, and I just want to mention that. I really appreciate your work. Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, they've never really been able to address in a convincing way the question of motive with Dr. Ivins. In the very early stories, there was an assertion that he had a couple of patents that could have led to some financial benefit if a new generation anthrax vaccine were developed, and that perhaps, you know, one of the motives might have been, hey, let's show how dangerous the stuff is, then everybody will have to be vaccinated, and the company making the new vaccine will make a lot of money, and I'll make a lot of money. But that's pretty much been shot down, because since he was an Army scientist, and the patent was actually held by the U.S. Army, the chance of a huge financial boon from the vaccine production, it just wasn't realistic.
One of the key facts in the case, or the key pieces of evidence that the FBI presented to make their case that indeed Bruce Ivins was the person who was responsible, they used scientific testing to establish the fact that the strain of anthrax used in the attacks was one that he worked with. At the same time, other people have said, well, yes, while that is true, he wasn't the only person who had access to that.
Correct.
How do they deal with that fact, and how did they, in the way that they talk about their evidence, how do they respond to that question, concern that, well, yes, he did work with this, but other people could have gotten to this material also?
Well, just let me back up a little bit to explain a little of why this particular batch of anthrax was so distinctive. Yes, it was the Ames strain, but it was a concoction of Ames strain that Dr. Ivins, who was known around Fort Detrick as sort of the anthrax man, he was the one who could propagate anthrax and create different formulations of it. He, in his lab, had created a little batch of anthrax that he had developed using spores that he had gotten from Dugway Proving Ground, another Army facility, and he'd mixed them with some other stuff that he had in his fridge. You know, he had a lot of different types of anthrax there, and so he had created a really distinctive concoction that had a special label that the FBI in its documents will refer to anthrax from this specific vial. And so it's sort of like a cooked stew. That's what he had created. They have acknowledged that 100 people, everyone from cleaning people who worked in the laboratory to scientists in Michigan or elsewhere who he may have been working with on various experiments, 100 people had access to his little concoction, which was apparently about the size of a half a pint of milk. That's the quantity we're talking about. You can take a few spores of anthrax and cultivate a truckload over time. It grows very easily and rapidly in the laboratory conditions. And so, you know, they were able to say, hey, 100 people could have touched this stuff over the course of time. That's one of the unresolved questions. How did they eliminate each one of the other 99 people?
We are at our midpoint here. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Marilyn Thompson. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and editor for The Washington Post. She's the author of a book on the anthrax attacks. The title is The Killer Strain, Anthrax and a Government Exposed, published by HarperCollins. We're talking about recent developments in the case. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here. Next, someone on a cell phone. This is our line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I look forward to reading your book. Recently, I kind of wanted to touch on something about basically what you were just talking about, there being somebody else involved. I read a book shortly after, I'm not sure how shortly after, the attacks occurred, called Demon in the Freezer.
Yeah, Richard Preston's book.
Yeah, Richard Preston. And, boy, I'll tell you, the guy can write a nightmare of a novel.
Yeah, he can.
Anyway, learning about you, Samrat, and you know, the way things are basically guarded, that weapons-grade anthrax as well as smallpox, anything that is virulent that could easily be used as a weapon in mass proportion, was kept under such lock and key. I mean, they put them in safes. They put them. They moved them constantly. They had them chained to the floor. All kinds of stuff. At least by the way Preston talked, I just don't see how one person could possibly do so. It's like you know, you shove it in your pocket and walk out the door with it. I just you know, unless he was growing it in his backyard or in a tool shed, I just don't know how in the world he could have walked out with it.
Well, I think that they believe that he may have essentially done that, created it in his lab and walked out with it one night. You would notice if you looked at all the FBI documents that they documented a pattern of very late night work right before these letters went out. And they thought that was unusual for Dr. Ivins, that he would come back to the lab after dinner and spend, you know, 2.5-3 hours there for a series of nights before the letters went out. So their theory was, yeah, he concocted it right there in our own U.S. government lab and took it out.
I don't understand how he could get out the door with it. I'm going to hang up and listen, but it just seems to me that that on so many levels, that's just as much, you know, lab security's fault for even allowing it to get out the door, let alone, you know, I mean, if you're going to blame people, you know. So anyway, I'm going to hang up and listen.
Thanks. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think you would find that lab security at that time in 2000, 2001, was much different than it is now in the wake of these anthrax attacks, because the anthrax attacks caused a big, big reevaluation of how laboratories were handling, you know, dangerous substances. And there's been a lot of outcry from the scientific community that things have gotten ridiculous. You have to register usage of these materials. You when you're in the lab, you're watched by cameras. So that didn't exist at this time. They did have, of course, at that time, security at USAMRID. And there's been a lot written about how there were major lapses in the security there at that time. So I don't know. They have not documented that he took it out of that lab, but I think that is their operating theory. And it's certainly a frightening and sobering theory for all of us to think that here was, you know, a terrorist in our midst working in one of the most secure government labs in America, and in fact working closely with the FBI even as it began to evaluate these attacks.
And the amount of material that we're talking about wouldn't really be that large, would it be? It would have been something that you could have put in a small bottle or a test tube or something like that and put into your pocket without any difficulty.
You could definitely have put the amount of material in all of these letters into a Ziploc baggie, maybe put another one on top to protect yourself a little more, and walked out with it. And he was vaccinated against anthrax. That was standard procedure for anyone working in the lab. And so he did have some protection as he handled that material.
We have some other callers. We'll go next to Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. Since there is so much ambiguity in this, it leaves a lot of room for speculation. And I don't think we should, you know, calling him a terrorist implies that he has a motivation that, you know, is understandable, typically in a political realm, which may or may not have been the case. There's a legal scholar who called in on this subject not so long ago, and he's written a book on bio treaties and chemical treaties. That's Francis Boyle, and he pointed out that several days after this, there was actually a vote about biological and chemical weapons money research, et cetera. So that is interesting. The whole milieu of the time was, this is right after September 11th. Judith Miller, apparently without Mike Gordon, was agitating that this was Iraqi, had to be because of bentonite or something like that, which wasn't in it. And so I'm just trying to evoke this whole time of paranoia and extremism that was rampant. I'm wondering whether you, if you have time in your book to treat that, or whether you have an opinion on that. I just think it's very amazing that this vote came. You wouldn't think they would need to do anything like that. And I know this sounds really paranoid, but like I say, when it's still open to question, it leaves a lot of room for this kind of speculation. So I'd like to hear some of yours.
First of all, I didn't mean to call him a terrorist. I'm still trying to weigh the evidence against him and decide if I think he really did it or not.
Right.
But I think that the notion that, you know, the person who committed this crime came from USAMRIT, they have been definitive about that for some time. That's frightening. Because we did, for a period of time after these letters went out, have a lot of speculation about foreign terrorists pulling this off. Maybe this was the 9/11 hijackers. In fact, the FBI went down after these letters surfaced in Florida and did a complete sweep of every residence where these 9/11 terrorists had lived, thinking perhaps it's somehow related to the hijackings. So, yeah, it led to huge, huge conspiracy theories and paranoia about foreign terrorism, that the supplies the anthrax supplies had come in from an enemy. It wasn't that complex, apparently. It was much more likely to be someone with a personal mission to convince people that this stuff was dangerous and that we needed to up the funding, spend, you know, billions of dollars more to protect ourselves against biological agents that might fall into terrorist hands.
And that could be one individual, that could be a group of individuals. I mean, I'm afraid there are a lot of candidates.
Yeah, there are certainly a lot of candidates. And again, you know, that was one of the things that led them in the beginning to finger Dr. Hatfill, because he had been one of these people putting on the, you know, protective suits and demonstrating to the public how hard it is to handle these materials. And, you know, there were photographs of him working in his kitchen on preparing some kind of concoction while wearing a full mask and protective gear. So there's a big bioterrorism community out there now, with a lot of people who believe that this is a top national concern and should be a big spending priority.
I don't know why they needed to emphasize that, though. I mean, it was right after 9/11. You think they could have gotten almost anything through. The attention on Hatfill is interesting in itself because of the reasons why he was a person of interest. I mean, connections to South Africa and a possible research down there that was supposed to differentially affect the black population, a very bizarre. Hails from Mattoon, Illinois, too, actually, right, with
yes.
The radio range. But anyway, it's going to remain a mystery, but I think people shouldn't rule out what the amount of money that's gone into bioterrorism and has fed the genetics research industry. It just seems maybe it is just crass and then people can always self-serve themselves, too, and think that they're actually on a mission to
yes.
make people believe how important it is to have defenses against this, but actually public more money into public health is probably a better way to go than researching thank you for letting me go on.
Oh, sure.
Well,
you probably remember after these incidents that there was a big national concern here in Washington about the fact that we didn't have enough anthrax vaccine to vaccinate large portions of the American population. And there was a huge clamor for vaccine development and for buying up the supplies that existed at the only licensed anthrax vaccine maker up in Michigan. And, you know, in retrospect, it all seems a little silly. But, boy, at the time, that was the hue and cry, and the government spent billions of dollars buying anthrax vaccine to put into the national stockpile in case the emergency ever arose.
Well, there you could imagine at least three different motivations for someone to do something like this. One would be that it would be a pure act of terrorism, that they were just interested in scaring and hurting people. One would be that it would be an individual that somehow would have a way to profit from this. And then perhaps the third would be the individual who was trying to sound the alarm bells, you know, the individual who's saying, look, this is a real threat and we need to prepare to meet it, and we haven't. So it's a way of scaring people into doing something. Was there some point at which the profile of the individual, the person they thought they were looking for, switched from maybe one and or two to the third one?
No, the original FBI profile, which is, again, an investigative technique that they use by having their experts draw a picture of the likely culprit, it never changed. I mean, it remains what they had in 2001, and you could put that profile up against Dr. Ivins and see some similarities, and you could put it up against earlier suspects and see some similarities. So I'm not sure that it was necessarily the best guide.
We have other callers. Let's talk with someone in Normal. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
How are you? Yeah, I was wondering, since the Bush administration likes to specialize in their fear tactics against Americans, I was always wondering, like, since John Ashcroft and Dick Cheney and Karl Rove were pushing real hard on that Patriot Act bill, and Tom Daschle came back and had some reservations about it, and Patrick Leahy was taking his time with it, and all of a sudden this anthrax thing came up. I mean, how do we know we could trust the FBI? What about an independent investigation on this whole matter? And also, wasn't Rumsfeld connected to some company where he was like a board of director of the company that actually produced the vaccine for anthrax?
I don't think that was Rumsfeld. There was a military connection to the original anthrax vaccine, the Bioport vaccine. That was Admiral Crow, former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But would an independent investigation teach us anything? I think so. Short of that, I certainly hope that the FBI feels compelled to present the record of this case to the American public so that we can see how this really came together. I mean, they've now truly fingered a dead man.
I mean, that's the comment I wanted to make before I get off the air, is that I feel like the only way the FBI could clear their name is they would have to make all these records public, because everything the Bush administration does is basically, you know, they don't open up their records or they cover everything up. And I just feel like, you know, we don't know if there was a third party involved. We don't know. And they got it wrong the first time with Hatfield. So I don't trust the whole story. And I just had reservations about this whole thing with the Patriot Act coming down the way it did. And Tom Daschle having reservations, like I said, and not to repeat myself, but also Patrick Leahy taking his time with the bill. There was some stories going on in Capitol Hill that the Bush administration was getting very, very upset, to the point of almost violent, to the point that they wanted that bill passed through, whether they had a chance to look at it or not look at it, or make revisions to it or not make revisions to it, and that's just the way it was.
Hmm. Let me just ask you, I appreciate the comments of the caller, by the way. Let me ask you, Ms. Thompson, as people probably will recall, these letters went to they went to a couple of newspapers. They went to the New York Post and to the National Enquirer, to NBC, ABC, CBS, and to these offices of these two senators, Tom Daschle and Mr. Leahy. Does the FBI have an explanation for why it was those two particular senators, Mr. Daschle and Mr. Leahy, were the ones that got the letters?
Well, they speculate on that in the documents that they filed a few weeks ago. First of all, they make the point that in the searches of Dr. Ivan's house, they found many unsent letters to media publications and to members of Congress and public officials. Everyone knew this guy wrote a lot of letters. He was published in his local newspaper with a lot of letters to the editor, and he had a lot of opinions, many of them, you know, kind of interesting and highly liberal. But what is mysterious in the FBI documents as an operating theory about the two senators, it mentions that they had strong views on abortion, and that Dr. Ivins's wife had been involved in a Catholic Church anti-abortion group. It was unconvincing to me because there was no proof that he held that opinion. In fact, as I say, some of his views tended to skew toward the liberal side of things. So I found that to be an unconvincing argument.
We have about 7-8 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Marilyn Thompson. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, editor at The Washington Post. She's authored a book about the anthrax attacks. It was published first in 2003. The title of her book is The Killer Strain, Anthrax and a Government Exposed, published by HarperCollins. We have some other callers here, and we'll talk next with someone on a cell phone. This is line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My first question is about the Doug Way sheet. My recollection isn't clear about the year, but I do remember when 6,000 or 7,000 sheep mysteriously died near Doug Way, Utah.
I don't know the details of that, and that didn't surface in this case.
So you don't recall that incident?
I wouldn't be able to really comment on that in a professional way because I just don't know enough about it.
But you do know that it did happen.
I've heard that happened, yes. And Doug Way handles many, many dangerous materials. There's no doubt about that. And there have been other incidents emanating from Doug Way.
I remember when that happened. And what struck me about that was the immediate denial by our government that it had anything to do with Doug Way. To me, that was both demeaning and, in other words, sheep just don't die.
Right.
In large quantities for no reason at all. And the fact is that Doug Way is or was a place where biological weapons were being developed. That leads me to wonder very much about government truthfulness in a broad sense. Well, why should any of us believe anything the government says? As a person, I want to believe everything. But as a pragmatist, when such things happen that are almost certainly the result of action by our government, why doesn't it admit it? Why doesn't it say, yeah, we messed up? When it doesn't, it just drives, bothers me because then I can't believe anything. What's your view on that larger issue, if I may ask?
Well, you're singing to the choir, as they say, because I'm a 55-year-old woman who went into this case still pretty much believing that the FBI was capable of solving this mystery. I got very involved with some of the victims of this attack. Felt very deeply for them and their families, and really was relying on the FBI to do a good job with this. And I've been completely disillusioned by their performance. So I want answers just like you and others want answers. I don't understand how this case was so badly handled. And all of it cloaked in a very, very thick veil of secrecy. So I'm with you on that.
Thank you so much. Well, I pray for change.
All right.
Thanks for the good show. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you. We'll talk with someone else here on our line number one, also somebody on cell phone. Hello.
Hi. Hope you can hear me okay.
Yes.
I don't know if I've got a lot to contribute to what you've been saying, and I didn't actually hear the first few minutes of the show, but it when this recently resurfaced, Dr. Ivins and all, and it brought to mind that there had been some 9/11 connection, I thought, so I looked back and tried to figure out what that was, and I'm sure the author is familiar with the original, the first anthrax-related death down in Florida, and I noticed that that's almost never mentioned now when we're talking about the anthrax attack. They're always focused on what went on in Washington or wherever, but the very first attack in a pretty obscure office in Florida.
Exactly.
I mean, formerly the National Enquirer's office, and that this man who died, one of his bosses was a landlord of the 9/11 conspirators who were in Florida, and it always struck me at that time and now that would be just for a fantastic conspiracy theory, and I never really hear it mentioned, and it seems like people are missing the boat for, if nothing else, a great conspiracy. At the time, of course, they're pushing for Saddam Hussein as being behind anthrax or whatever, but it seemed that they're fanning the flames of hysteria, they could more easily jump on a 9/11 connection just through this. I mean, perhaps it's coincidental. I don't have any theory really hatched myself, but it seemed you have two completely separate terrorist conspiracies operating who overlap in this one individual, and out of a country of 300 million people, that would seem to be not very obvious, not very likely to happen.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know what she thought about the Florida situation.
Yeah, I'm interested in Ms. Thompson, what you would say just about that piece of the story, because I think that there also are still some questions that attach to that piece of it.
Well, the FBI was the one that really dismissed the notion that this could have been the 9/11 terrorists. They, as I said earlier, they went to Florida. That was the first case. The victim was Bob Stevens, who was a photojournalist working with the National Star. And they did a full sweep of every place that those terrorists had lived in South Florida looking for anthrax spores because it was believed that if they had done this, they would find some evidence. They didn't find anything. And they were very quick to shut down that line of thinking.
Let me just ask you about one other point here. We are getting short on time. We have about a minute or two left. As people will recall, these letters were mailed through the U.S. mail and were apparently put into a letterbox in New Jersey.
Princeton, yes.
Princeton, New Jersey. And the... although in their talking about their evidence against Dr. Ivins, that the FBI said they could not place him in New Jersey. They didn't have anybody who said they had seen him there. They didn't have anybody saying they had seen him put the letters into the mailbox. How did they explain, or did they try to explain how, if indeed he was the person and he was the only person responsible, how it is he got the letters into that mailbox?
Well, they never pinned him to Princeton, New Jersey. They however, made an insinuation that he would have been interested in Princeton, New Jersey, and that particular mailbox, because it was only a short distance from a Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority storage facility, which is, to me, kind of preposterous. He was obsessed with Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority sisters for some unknown reason. But they never proved that he went to New Jersey. And, in fact, they did sampling from hair found inside that mailbox hoping that they would be able to find a DNA match, and they didn't. So they have no real evidence that he was ever at that mailbox or put those letters in. He did have a pattern, they said, of unexplained late-night travel in which he would hop in his car and just take off.
But they still maintain that he did this alone, that he didn't have any help, no accomplices, nobody else was involved, and it was just him.
Yeah, to me, that's one of the unanswered questions that, you know, I think the FBI needs to explain how they think those letters got into those mailboxes.
And in one of the stories that I read recently, I'm pretty sure that this was a story that was in the Post, and I'm not sure if this is one of the ones that you contributed to or not. There was somebody from the FBI being quoted essentially as saying that he doesn't really think that this will ever be settled to everyone's satisfaction.
Yes, they've said that, and that's really unfortunate because, as I said earlier, the guy's dead, and it's very easy to hang a case on somebody who's not there to defend themselves.
Do you think that it was the case that his suicide was directly the result of the pressure that he faced, that he was aware that he was the target of the investigation?
I think I have a story that's coming out very soon, but one of the interesting factoids is that, you know, he went to the Frederick County Public Library on his the night before he took all those pills, and went to one of the library computers, pulled up an anthrax website, and on the day that he pulled up the site, the homepage talked about how the FBI was closing in. It was very clear that this man's anxiety was building. He and his attorney had been warned that an indictment would be coming, and he promptly left the library, went home, and began sedating himself.
And just as a way of finishing up, you seems very clear that you still have questions about who it was responsible, and perhaps have some questions at least about whether in fact it was Dr. Ivins and whether in fact there was anybody else involved.
I'm most concerned about the other people who may have been involved.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. If you're interested in reading the story of the anthrax attacks, you can go and see if you can find Marilyn Thompson's book, The Killer Strain, Anthrax and a Government Exposed, published by HarperCollins. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, editor for The Washington Post. And Ms. Thompson, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much.